Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The Joint Finance Committee readies itself for a marathon day of budget decisions days out from the end of the fiscal year. Plus, the Wisconsin Supreme Court sides with the Republican legislature in a question over a governor's veto power. And the High Court declines to hear lawsuits that could have changed Wisconsin's congressional maps. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 27th. I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Hey, J.R.
How's it going today?
Well, it is an early morning
because
we are about to embark on a marathon budget session. We have more than 50 topics coming down the line today on a Friday, which is unusual. We have DOA, the Department of Administration, also known as the Department of All, catch-all, DOJ, agriculture, tourism, transportation, and then some of the biggest ticket, kind of most controversial areas are coming up today as well. University of Wisconsin system, corrections, child care, DNR, DHS. Could be a really late night for the two of us. What are you hearing, and how did we get to this point of needing to be in a marathon budget session?
Well, what I'm hearing is Republicans in both the Assembly and Senate met for a joint caucus on Wednesday, which is rare. A sign of kind of like, okay, we get stuff done. Robin Voss emerged from that. I caught him afterward. He said, our goal is to get the budget done at the end of next week. And he felt good. He told me to watch the magic. They're going to get it done by the end of next week. Okay. So now the question is, what's going to be in this thing? Early suggestions are they're trying to talk, at least talking about, things like a small bump in state aid for University of Wisconsin system paired with quote-unquote reforms. And what those are, we don't know yet. But remember, the system wanted $855 million. We heard about a potential cut of $87 million. Evers said, I will not go for that whatsoever. So that's maybe a way for compromise, a small bump for UW, but then you add whatever your reforms are. Special education. I remember the Finance Committee already took up K-12. They pushed special ed's reimbursement to 37.5% the second year of the biennium, or about 32% right now. The governor wanted 60. So they're not going to go to 60. That's about $1.1 billion. But somewhere north of 37.5 might be the magic number. There's also talk about the tax package sticking and something to address Evers' call for, hey, you need to kind of do something about child care costs. What that is, we don't know. These are always moving pieces. I know members are meeting late last night, continue the conversations. They're meeting again this morning. The governor's office told me that early today, no deal with him yet. So that's where we're at right now.
And Evers has said that he'll veto over child care. So we actually have a little bit of video about what the back and forth between the governor and lawmakers has looked like.
Yeah. Should we watch that now?
I think we are.
Okay.
Republicans need to get their act together and come back and let's finish it up. Compromise is what happens when you have a similar number of Democrats and Republicans, which we do, and we have a Democrat governor that is willing to compromise also, but we need to finish this up.
We're going to find ways to spend Wisconsin's money prudently, conservatively, and meaningfully and thoughtfully as we move forward. The demographics of our state require it. We can't do some of the things we used to do in the manner we did it. So that's why we are committed to change, we are committed to improvement, and we are committed to progress as we move forward.
Okay, so with all of that, the fiscal year ends on Monday. Mm-hmm. So what does this mean? Where do we kind of go from here?
Okay, so in theory, I stress in theory, Joint Finance will meet at some point today and begin to go through these motions, all these big ticket items that they need to knock out. In theory, they could also come back tomorrow on Saturday and finish it up. In theory, you then have to draft the bill. This might sound odd to people at home, but just because they pass a motion in the Finance Committee doesn't mean the budget's done. You have to actually draft the language to pass a bill. So in theory, then you take, used to take 5 to 7 days back in the olden days, and that's sound old, get that done, but it sounds like they could wrap it up in time that in theory, you could be on the floor Wednesday in one house, in theory, another the next day, and in theory, it's done before July 4th weekend. Now that's all in theory. The key is, how do you get to an agreement that passes both houses and meets the governor's approval? One challenge is the Senate. That is probably the biggest challenge. In talking to people in the Assembly, Republicans, they are totally in line. We've got 50 votes. We're going to be fine. Remember those benchmarks, 50 in the Assembly for Republicans, 17 in the Senate, because you want to pass a budget without Democratic support. The Senate, though, I have yet to meet anybody who could tell me a way that the Senate would pass a budget that had 17 GOP votes and would get the governor's signature. It's just not, in their minds, possible. A couple reasons why. Chris Capia has said in a Facebook post, for example, that he doesn't like the trajectory of where things are going. He actually kind of prefers no budget. Now, remember, if we don't pass a budget by June 30th, Monday, no big deal. Things go on as is. But if you don't pass one at all in a two-year period, things start to happen. For example, Medicaid, one of our biggest expenses in Wisconsin, just to continue the program as is about another $1.6 billion state money. Well, if you don't pass a budget, everything continues as is current spending levels. At some point in the two-year period, health services would run out of cash to pay for Medicaid. That would be a problem. Corrections, for example, prison guards, their overtime costs often come in over budget. That's been a recurring thing. At some point in the two-year period, you could run out of money to pay the prison guards their overtime. Okay, so that's not realistic. Steve Nass from Whitewater, he put out a benchmark of four things he wants to have in the budget to sign it, for get his support. One, he wants most of the surplus to go toward a $3.5 billion tax rebate. Now, that's attracted him because it wouldn't be an ongoing cost. Remember the structural deficit? We've talked to the show before. That is when you have future commitments that exceed current revenues. A tax cut counts as a future commitment. A rebate, though, is a one-time use of cash. So $3.5 billion toward a rebate. He wants a structural deficit, no structural, or a very small structural deficit. Oh, $1.5 billion, I think it is. Oh, and he wants to cut base spending of every agency across the board around $700 billion. Now, that may be a good idea, not judging that. But there is no world I know of in which Governor Evers signs a budget that cuts spending when we have a $4.3 billion surplus. Okay, so those two are likely off the table. 18 minus 2 is 16. So the question becomes, how do you get Democratic support to pass a budget? So the theory is that there'll be something that'll emerge from the Finance Committee that the governor agrees to, and then he can bring along Democratic votes to pass the budget. The question is, how many would he need to do that? And I don't have that answer right now because we haven't seen the deal. The governor's signed on, so as you can tell, I keep using the word in theory, because in theory we can have a budget done by Thursday in the governor's desk. But there are a number of roadblocks to get there. Finance Committee says it's going to come in at 10 o'clock this morning. I have heard from numerous people. The chances of that are slim to none.
That's also in theory.
Yes,
yeah.
In theory. So, you know, there are a lot of roadblocks to go. Again, so we have time. The 30th is an artificial deadline. It's more of like a symbolic thing. But there is at some point something has to be done. But the other thing to remember is we're getting close to July. People have vacations. They weren't expecting to be in. So it gets harder to get people back to the Capitol to pass it. They want to get it done because if you have a deal, it's one of the rules in politics. If you have a deal, you go to the floor and do it before they go home and get have second thoughts. So it's a long way of saying I see a path for my conversations. I don't see the light yet in the tunnel that tells me we have a deal on the governor's desk by the end of the next week.
Yeah, I think we'll get a lot of clarity in the next, I don't know, 12 to 24 hours, yes. However long today goes.
One 36, of the things, 48, somewhere around there.
You know, from your lips. But one of the things that we're also going to be seeing at JFC today is the release of the DPI funds, about $50 million from to the Department of Public Instruction to support this literacy bill. Can you talk a little bit about what is that money? Where is it coming from? And again, why is it coming up today on this Friday marathon session? Why does it need to be dealt with right now?
2 years ago, lawmakers and the governor agreed on this literacy package. It was, though, broken into three bills because Republicans have been paranoid about the governor and his partial veto authority. Governors can only use that on a bill of an appropriation. They broke it into three pieces. One, the $50 million was in the budget itself. They had a bill that had some of the policy, and a third bill that had how the money would be appropriated, not actually an appropriation. And actually, it said in the text, there are $0 appropriated in this bill. The governor still uses partial veto authority on that third bill to change the appropriation process. That became a big thing. Finance said, we're not releasing this money because we don't like what you did. It became a lawsuit. The Supreme Court finally released a ruling this week that said the governor was wrong in what he did. The deadline is Monday. If you don't appropriate that money, release it to DPI by Monday, it's called a lapse. It goes back to the state's main checking account, the general fund. You have to process over again. So there's a deadline here to meet, to release that money, to open the door to the schools being reimbursed these costs.
So that kind of gets us into our next topic, which is where that Supreme Court decision came from. We had a bit of a SCOUS-a-palooza is one of the phrases that I heard tossed around. I don't know how I feel about that. But one of them was about releasing this money. So on Wednesday, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that Evers had exceeded his veto authority. Wisconsin governors had that very unique partial veto power. They can strike words or sentences. And so he tried to use that on that bill about literacy instruction. It was sort of a wonky situation. The legislation was broken up into pieces. There was the appropriations part. There was the policy part. And the governor tried to veto the part of the bill that did not contain an appropriation. And so the Supreme Court found that you can only partially veto a bill that has an appropriation. So a really kind of technical decision. But can you talk a little bit about that rule and kind of what that means for Evers going forward? Yeah,
it adds a definition to what appropriation is, appropriating public money for a public purpose. Now, still kind of a legalese term, but still, you actually have to have money in the bill to have an appropriation bill to be subject to that power. What's interesting is the Supreme Court has had a fourth liberal majority since August of 2023 after Janet Prosewicz won that race and flipped control. They have issued a series of decisions, most notably the one overturning the legislative maps, that have labeled this court, you know, activists, partisans, whatever word you want to use, by conservatives. This week kind of flipped that on its head, starting with that decision. Not really even one before that, but this one, 7-0, the governor exceeded authority. It's a rare rebuke for governor from the Supreme Court, number one, or for a Democratic cause to lose, number two. But their court was unanimous, pretty straightforward decision, no bombastic end passages from the justices. Everybody's on the same page. So, kind of interesting. Nice, straightforward, easy 19-page decision.
Easy. And we have some responses from lawmakers. So the co-chairs of the JFC who are affected by this said, we are happy to see that the court ruled in favor of the legislature as a co-equal branch of government. So again, that sort of separation of powers question. Now that there is clarity, we look forward to releasing the $50 million set aside to support kids struggling to read. It is unfortunate that the governor's unconstitutional veto has delayed this funding needed by kids and families across the state. So shots fired a little bit there. Evers responds, I will never apologize for fighting for our kids and our schools. Nearly $50 million to help improve our kids' reading has sat unspent in Madison for 2 years because Republican lawmakers refused to release it. I will accept the court's decision because I remain as faithful as ever to the oath I swore and to the Constitution. So as you say, Republicans really kind of painting this as a rebuke to Evers' authority. And it's been interesting kind of seeing some of the push and pull about separation of powers coming out of this court. So you alluded to another unanimous decision last week that was granting the DOJ and Attorney General Josh Call authority over settling cases that had previously been given to the JFC. And so that was seen as sort of a victory for the executive branch. Last year, there was a ruling about conservation funding through Knowles Nelson that was also seen as a victory for the executive branch. And so we are seeing some of these definitions coming out of the court about separation of powers here in the state. But that was not at all the only decision to come out of the Supreme Court this week. There was another major one, which was the decision actually not to hear a case about redistricting congressional maps. So that was actually an unsigned rejection. There were two lawsuits filed to try to overturn the U.S. House maps in a similar style to how the state legislative maps were overturned 2 years ago. I think we're coming on. They didn't offer an explanation. What are you seeing in sort of why that wasn't taken up? If you can speculate.
I don't want to say I told you so, but I remember sitting here and talking about all the challenges these lawsuits faced. One of them is they argued that these maps were based on a foundation that doesn't exist anymore. So let's kind of do a history lesson. Back in 2011, Republicans had full control of the Capitol. They passed new maps for the legislature and for Congress. In 2021, you had Democratic Governor Tony Evers, Republican lawmakers couldn't agree. They go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, with a conservative majority of the time, says you must take a least change approach to those maps from 2011 when you propose new lines to us. Okay, in the end, the court picked the legislature's least change approach maps, but the governor's least change approach congressional map. Fast forward to 2023, new liberal majority, a lawsuit challenging legislative maps. They overturn those maps. In the process, they say the least change approach foundation is not valid. In 2024, there was a lawsuit filed by Mark Elias, this kind of dumb super attorney, said, hey, if you can't have least change approach for legislative maps, well, then the correctional map should be thrown out. Court unanimously rejected that. Okay, so there's your history lesson. So here we have these two lawsuits. One, they argued least change doesn't exist anymore or shouldn't, map should go out. Okay, challenge number one, how do you get the court to basically change its mind on a principle that's already said, we're not touching that? Number two, one of the lawsuits argued that the maps split too many counties and that the deviation in population between the districts was too much. It has to be one person. Some of them have a difference of two people. Now, I stress often, I'm not an attorney. But in speaking to the ones who are, they have argued to me that that's not usually a standard used to overturn an entire congressional map. The other lawsuit argued this was a partisan gerrymander, the original map in 2011, partisan gerrymander that's resulted in a 6-2 majority for Republicans in this congressional map, even though Wisconsin is a 50-50 state. The problem there is evidence suggests it was not a partisan gerrymander. It was an incumbent protection act or incumbent make them happy act. What I mean by that is there was a challenge to the original map in 2011. It came out in testimony from a guy who was the chief of staff to Paul Ryan, former Speaker of the House, kind of the lead of the delegation, who testified, I was basically tasked with drawing the map. That's our tradition. Our tradition has been the people in the delegation draw the map and give it to lawmakers. I was told by Paul Ryan to be bipartisan, to be fair. They asked members what their concerns were. For example, Sean Duffy, then a congressman in northern Wisconsin, just elected in 2010, did say, I want my district to be more Republican. But Tammy Baldwin in the House and Tom Petri said, you know, I want to make sure my district is compact enough I can drive around it and meet people. Reed Ribble, then in the House, said, you know, if I have to add territory, I'd take Calumet County because I've got property down there. These are not partisan concerns. These are more like what makes me convenient or is convenient for me. Ron Kind, for example, saw one map that had the second going all the way to the Mississippi River and said, "This, no, I am the Mississippi River guy. This is my district." So they didn't get into the kind of that background. But if they had, you would have had a challenge in convincing this court this is a partisan gerrymander. And oh, by the way, the final hurdle, if the court had taken this case, you had the U.S. Supreme Court over here, the supreme arbiter of the law of the land, who could have stepped in and said, this is going to be a problem. So for those who were like banking on this happening, there are a lot of hurdles that said it's not going to happen. But I think it kind of became a thing this spring and took off. And that's, I think, something you've kind of been talking about, why it may become an issue this spring.
Yeah, I mean, I think you talk about people banking on it. It really was a major campaign line through the spring Supreme Court race. And I have a little bit also of that I told you so feeling, because I would get these phone calls from national journalists saying, congressional maps. And to me, that was much more something that national actors were interested in kind of using to attract national donations, because how do you, you know, explain the national stakes of a state Supreme Court race? Congressional redistricting is a really great issue to hang your hat on. It's either this gives Dems more opportunities, come on Dem donors, or this gives Dem more opportunities, come on Republican donors. And so I really think that got leveraged in the campaign in a way that was maybe an outsized representation of how likely this lawsuit was, and we saw exactly how likely it was this week.
So Elon Musk, I think it was like a couple weeks before the election, said that this race between Brad Schimmel and Susan Crawford would determine the maps in Wisconsin, determine the control of the House, and could actually impact the trajectory of humankind, I think was his phrase. A little bit dramatic, but that said, it underscores your point. $109 million and counting. We'll get final tallies in a couple weeks from the candidates, but that helped drive that spending, especially for Republicans. The idea of defending this map helped drive that interest and bring outside groups in.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, these were not the only cases. Again, this was SCOUSAPALOOZA. I don't know why I keep repeating that phrase. We had a couple other big decisions I will just kind of quickly talk about. So there was Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce versus the DNR. This is about the PFAS rulemaking process. Court decided that DNR can enforce reporting and cleaning up things like PFAS and other kind of toxic spills. It upheld the Wisconsin spills law. The Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the plaintiff in the case, says these are basically unworkable regulations. It puts the onus on small businesses and homeowners to kind of guess what is toxic in their area and clean it up or be fined. Evers and other environmentalists say it's a win for the environment and public health. Scott Van Udenhoven versus the DOJ. This is about handgun purchases. And I thought this was a really interesting case. There's a federal law that says if a person is convicted of domestic violence, they can't purchase a gun. This was a person who was convicted of domestic violence charge, but it was later expunged. So then he tried to purchase a handgun, was blocked, and brought this lawsuit forward. The court actually declined to take it up. They didn't rule on the case. They dismissed it. They said, the liberal justices said that this is not the right case to sort of figure out how federal law applies here. Conservative justices disagreed. And then there was Nicole McDaniel versus the DOC about uncompensated time for corrections officers. So corrections officers, you know, before they start their shift, they go through a long security process. There might be kind of other things they need to do to sort of gear up, get their equipment. And so these correctional officers sued and said that they should be compensated for the time it takes to kind of get to the start of their shift. And so what this rules or what this ruling finds is that, not that compensation question again, but it finds that COs can form a unit to file a class action suit around those wages. So that might actually be a case that we kind of continue to see unfold. And then there was a new decision that came out early this morning, and you caught it sort of on your way in the door. So what was that?
Another 7-0 decision. So nurses at UW Health have been arguing that they should be able to recognize as a union. There's been this kind of dispute about whether Act 10, the law signed by Scott Walker in 2011, applied to them. Court basically said, yeah, you guys can't get recognized. This is an airtight deal. So 7-0. Again, interesting splits. So 7-0 on that, 7-0 on the congressional maps, 7-0 on the Evers veto, 5-2 on the spills law. This court is maybe not as like partisanly divided as some people want to portray it as. Now, Republicans aren't going to like give you much credit for the court or say like, yeah, all of a sudden they've turned a leaf. They still see like, okay, once we see the Act 10 lawsuit that's now percolating in appeals court, once they get that, if they rule against us, okay, you know, that gig's over, you know. But anyway, interesting to break down these cases this past week.
Absolutely. And speaking of breaking down, I think we have a stocks report from you. So who is leading this week?
Rising. So Brian Style. So let's look at the impact of this MAP decision. Style, look, he won big under the old MAP that was a little more Republican back in 2018 and 2020. He's won under the new MAP that's a little less Republican in 22 and 24. The best chance of beating him is likely if you had a new MAP. Now, Democrats will tell you they're not going to drop this issue necessarily. They might try other ways. But for 26, at least, the door seems closed on that. So Style's not going to, you know, Rennie Bryce has announced, ran against Style back in 2018 on the old MAP. That was a little more Republican, lost by a dozen points. Look, really bad year for Republicans, maybe. Something goes wrong, maybe. But most people I talk to don't see a real path to beat Style with this MAP. Again, different lines, different story. Places all the emphasis on the third, Derek Van Orden. Hey, this decision is good for Republicans in general, especially Van Orden included. But he's still going to be a target. So if you had a chance to redraw the lines as a Democrat, you could have made this district more, you know, a little more Democratic. Maybe pick up some of Dane County-ish, you know, stretch it somewhere. But with that off the table, you still have Republican power of the White House, a guy in Van Orden who does not reach cross-party lines, is pretty bombastic on social media, who underperformed Trump in 2024, which has often been cited, and he's facing Rebecca Cookie and has proven to be a good fundraiser. Interesting note this week, Brad Path, state senator, considered a possible candidate, endorsed Cook, so he's not going to run. She's not getting a free pass. She's got two challengers for that Democratic nomination, but people see her as the best option to beat Van Orden. The challenge for her is, this is number three. She came in second in the primary in 22, lost Van Orden in 24. If you don't do it this time, it's kind of tough to keep making that argument that you should be the candidate going against Van Orden going forward.
All right, and so mixed in the stock report.
So Tony Evers, Marquette poll out this week. You know, a couple of interesting things in there. A lot of our brethren in the media focused on this question. Should Evers run again? 55% said somebody else. That's not the most useful question in polling these days and talking to my sources for a couple reasons. One, people have been unhappy for a long time with politicians. They always want change. And you're not running against somebody new, running against somebody with a name and a record. So that's maybe the best gauge where Evers is at. It's more that he's still net positive in his job approval, 48-46. Interesting, personal favorability, a little underwater, minus two, but he's the most popular person polled in the Marquette survey. He's minus two, Tammy Baldwin minus three, Ron Johnson minus four, Trump minus eight. So again, people aren't happy. I've asked this question over and over and over again in the last year or so. Will Evers run again? And the answer I keep getting back is, we don't know for sure. If his health is good, his wife's health is good, if his team wants to run again, he likes the job, he'll probably run. The caveat has always been, but he'd be 79 in the third term. Now, look out at New York this week with the primary there for mayor. You can't ignore the generational thing that happened there for Democrats. But Evers is really kind of Democrats' best bet. He's a proven quantity. He's raised money before. He's won. He's got great name ID. People are generally like him. Democrats have a deep bench. They don't have a bench that has experience winning a lot of statewide races or raising a lot of money. So, yes, there's Josh Call, the Attorney General, Sarah Rodriguez, Lieutenant Governor, David Crowley, the Milwaukee County Executive, and I could go on and on and on about potential candidates. They don't have a stature. One thing, though, that I heard from one of my sources this week was, with Evers, you just don't know. You look at these signs like, well, he proposed a budget that was going to no taxes on tips. Okay, that's populist. This guy's going to run. But, and he looks okay. I mean, he's not showing a Biden-like decline. You don't want to wake up in 3 years and go, I can't do this job anymore, right? Because we're talking like the end of the term is a ways away. So what's this going to mean for Evers? We'll finally get an answer, we think, if this budget, in theory, is done at the end of next week. The governor said, I'll make a decision after the budget.
That's right.
And in talking to people close to him, they've told me, we don't even know. He's not even telling us. We're waiting. And the sooner he decides, the better, A, if he's going to run to get the money machine going, to get the campaign out there and get fired up. And B, if he doesn't, all these people like Crowley, Rodriguez, Call, Sarah Galuski, Kevler Johnson, I can go on and on and on. They need time to raise money.
Mm-hmm. And they're all very careful to say, I'm not making any decision until the governor makes a decision.
And the last caveat is Republicans, there's nobody in this potential field right now. We only have Josh Shulman, the Washington executive, who screams, I'm the person to beat Tony Evers. They've always got this kind of like, well, what about this? So Josh, Tom Tiffin, Congressman Northern Wisconsin, Bill Berrien, a businessman from southeastern Wisconsin, there are numerous people who are thinking about it. Nobody's ever grasped that ring of I'm the person to do this yet. And the state party's a mess. Republican party's a mess. So it doesn't help in taking on Evers. So if he runs, probably in pretty good shape.
So as you say, the Republican Party is a mess. Yes. Who's falling this week?
So Brian Schimming. So I was on vacation last week, came back on Saturday. There's a story in the Journal Sentinel. Brian Schimming says he got a call from executive committee members saying you need to resign. And apparently he's given 24 hours to do it. Then went radio silence. Got some emails later on this week, or early this week, in which a member of the executive committee said, I was told by Bill Feehan, the first vice chair, that the effort to push out Schimming is off. And now there's like all this back and forth what's going on. So is Schimming safe? I don't know. It's this weird story that everyone in the Capitol is like, what is going on? Where did this come from? The bottom line is, it's not a great look. So let's kind of look at Brian Schimming's history. First paid chair of recent memory for Republicans, okay? The expectation was he'd raise more money and that would help the party with its coffers. There was this spring, they did pretty well compared to Democrats with that national influx of cash because of Elon Musk and others, the Supreme Court race, but they have not matched Democrats fundraising-wise overall. He was paid to do that. That's not going great. There's tension with Turning Point USA, this kind of conservative group that's been out there doing doors. There's tension in the grassroots. At convention, there was talk of, will there be a no-confidence vote in Brian Schimming? That faded away. And the line I heard at the convention was, as long as he has the executive committee behind him, he'll be fine. Well, I got executive committee members who want to push him out, okay? Same time, the fact this story blew up and then has kind of like died out suggests these people who are trying to push him out didn't have the support they thought they did. But what's next? Well, if you're a donor, do you want to give money to state GOP if you're not sure like what Brian Schimming's status is? And you've got to think that people at the national level are going, what is going on in Wisconsin? So just not a great look. I mean, Schimming, unless things turn, he's probably okay through the rest of this term. But if the executive committee wants him out, they can be ways to push him out. And it's just, again, just Republicans like this is an embarrassing story overall.
Yeah, so lots to look out for. And I think now we're about to go skedaddle to the Capitol to see if this budget hearing starts on time. I am Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Thank you so much for watching. See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.